Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Listen to Fresh Off the Field on your favourite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Marlo, Bulavanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It is Wednesday, December 24. I'm Kyle Evans. Happy Christmas Eve to you all, and thanks for tuning in ahead of what's sure to be a busy day for many in the Pacific. And if you haven't finished your Christmas shopping yet, I'm going to ask you to just hold on for just a little longer because we've got a big show coming up, starting in Palau, where documents have emerged linking international scammers to local businesses. Also, Tongans weigh in on new travel restrictions set to be imposed on those heading to the United States, and a renowned artist launches a campaign to save PNG's music industry from AI-generated covers.
People are trying to use it to gain more popularity and fame, but they don't see the main impact that it can give to us musicians and artists.
Yeah, it's a compelling listen to that one. We've got all that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, Vanuatu's National Teachers Union has ended an 18-month-long teachers' strike after reaching an agreement with the government. Under the collective bargaining agreement, the government will pay $54 million over the next 4 years to settle unpaid allowances, pay entitlements, and other teacher grievances. The union says the payment will go towards in-service teachers, those who have retired, and others who have since passed away. Union Secretary General Jonathan Yohan told the ABC's reporter in Vanuatu, Lily Rose Wellwell, that teachers will return to the classroom in the new academic year.
Yes, of course, the teachers' strike was initiated by one of the teachers' unions, so it was the one of the teachers' unions that called off the industrial action yesterday after the signing of the collective bargaining. So as it stands, there is no longer any industrial action or strike going on. All the teachers are getting ready to enter their classrooms, respective classrooms, in January 2026, 26th of January, to commence the academic year with all the qualified teachers who were on strike for almost 1.5 years.
Were teachers consulted and briefed before the signing of the collective agreement and were they all happy with the demands?
Yeah, there were mixed feelings. You know, because the teachers were almost 1.5 years, 1 year, 6 months, which the teachers were just, they're getting paid without doing any classroom work. So it's a mixed feeling yesterday. But the union, through the national executive, feels that it is timely to call off the industrial action so that all other stakeholders, the government, the parents, the students, and even the teachers will enjoy a part of the Christmas celebration and get ready to go back to work. Council of Ministers, for the first time in Vanuatu, the Council of Ministers has to endorse this collective bargaining agreement, CBA, yesterday before the signing, which means that the government has the obligation to fulfill all the conditions inside the collective bargaining agreement.
How confident is the union that the government will follow up on what it's been agreed, since it has been years since the teachers' issues have been tracked on?
The union is very confident just because the government has been committed over the few months to pay for the teachers' back pay and some other claims. So we are confident since signing it today. If we don't sign the agreement, some members will be left out. Especially the retired teachers and the deceased ones will not be part of the claims. So when the agreement was signed, we have a broader sense of giving this opportunity also to the members who have retired. Because what the government is doing now is just paying for the current teachers who are on strike. who are active members. But the union was established for over 40 years, and we have some teachers who have retired and some have passed away. We are very confident because there's also a trade monitoring committee which will be made up of members from the Prime Minister's Office, Ministry of Finance, Education, Ministry of Education, the Tutelus Commission, and the Vanuatu Teachers Union to continue to monitor the terms and conditions and report back to the government.
What assurances can you give to students and families when the school reopen regarding their learning?
Part of the, there's an article you said that CPA that states very clearly that all the teachers who will return, they will return to the classrooms that they were before 6-2 last year when the strike was initiated. So we were confident that these teachers will perform to another level. Because there will also be a restructuring of the education, education in Vanuatu. So these teachers, part of the agreement, CPA also says that the government has to consult with the teachers on any policies for the future. So we believe we are sure the parents that the teachers will be doing their best as they were. We also they've been doing it, but this one will. This time it will be better. That's what the call from union to all its members. Once they enter the classroom in 2026, the union expects more because the government has committed himself to pay for the claim. So we expect to see more from the teachers.
That was the Secretary General of Vanuatu's Teachers Union, Jonathan Yohan, marking the end of an 18-month-long industrial action that will see teachers returning to the classrooms in the new year. Well, international fraud and scam centres have been the big news in 2025, with police raiding hundreds of operations in Cambodia and Thailand and arresting thousands of people. But fraudsters have also been making their presence felt in the Pacific, with the authorities in Palau raiding two online scam centres at the start of the year. Now, 12 months on, documents linking workers at those centres to local business houses have emerged. The paperwork came to light during an investigation by the Organised Crime and Corruption Reporting Team, and Emmanuel Stokes, who is part of that team, joins us on the line now from New Zealand. Emmanuel, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Now, before we chat about the new developments, tell me what authorities found when they raided the Kokoro Hotel in Koro.
Well, yeah, it was a pretty unpleasant scene. There were people sort of, I mean, I've seen video and photos from it. So you had people surrounding tables with a lot of food and laptops and some pretty pale-faced, tired-looking young people who appeared to be working on their computers.
Yeah, it sounds like pretty nasty stuff. So just for our listeners who might not be aware, how do scam centres typically work and sort of how do they, just generally speaking, how do they operate and go about the deceptive traps that they lay for unsuspecting victims?
Well, it depends what scam you're talking about. But in this case, the evidence that we saw in the documents that we found alleged that they were trying to get people to engage in gambling until they had basically spent all of their money and wasted it all engaging in these Chinese language gambling sites, often using things like cryptocurrency and essentially being emotionally manipulated into spending everything that they had, believing they would get great big winnings. But that's a pattern that you also see in things like pig butchering, which is, I think, something that you alluded to earlier, which were the things that you see in Southeast Asia with things like the big scam hubs that have been raided recently and have been subject to sanctions by the United States.
Yeah, it's an evocative term, pig butchering, that's for sure. So who typically runs these organizations? Is it organized crime? And if so, where do they get their workforce from?
Well, I mean, speaking in very general terms, it is normally organized crime. And in some cases, you see examples of human trafficking, people being tricked into going to places like Cambodia on the promise of some fantastic IT job or something like that, to then suddenly find themselves essentially entrapped and having to raise, you know, a quota, a large amount of money by using investment scams, gambling scams, romance scams, that sort of thing. And the pig butchering element is a reference to the idea that you fatten the hog until it gets slaughtered. That means that you take you keep on engaging with them in over a long period of time until you take everything that they have. Although, I mean, in the cases in Palau, we see something which is similar but a little bit different, because they're primarily using gambling sites to be able to sort of trick people out of money, which distinguishes itself from some of the things that we saw in Southeast Asia, because it doesn't have a romance element to it.
I see. Now, as part of the OCCRP's investigation, documents have been uncovered linking the scam centre to local businesses in Palau. Can you take us through what was found in the document?
There were a lot of documents. So, I mean, in essence, there were two sites. There was one site in Mayans, which is to the west of Karor, and another that was inside of Karor, which is the main city of Palau. The first site, which was hit in early January, the second was hit in late January. The first site seemed to be doing illegal gambling, according to the assessments in the reports. The reports, by the way, came from government agencies and private firms that were commissioned by government agencies. And so in the first case in Baloo, you can see that the assessment of the private firm was that they were, based on devices that were seized from the site, was that they were essentially using psychological manipulation tactics to try and trick people to spend as much money as possible. And then they were using crypto, and there's some indication of involvement in a crypto scam where they drop worthless tokens into people's wallets, which then they try to redeem, only to find that actually they had, you know, potentially information stolen and money taken. And in the second case, there's one national security document which says that the people were inside the building, according to their own claims, for months or even years. That is to say, the workers. And again, it was sort of gambling, gambling-related stuff where people were being encouraged to spend as much money. But they also cloned websites, which is very interesting. Were able to manipulate the back end, so people would see the value of what they held appearing to be a certain number when it could be changed remotely.
With those like psychological manipulation tactics, I mean, how does that typically work? Do they stick to a script or something, or have they sort of got certain strategies they employ, and do they target specific people at all, or is it all just random?
No, it's not random. It's very well organized. And in the case of the second building that they raided, you can see from the seized devices, there's some very detailed stuff, which looks like a highly professional, sophisticated HR management style operation, where they're talking about people taking leave and so on, and how they operate the back end of the website. But typically, with these sorts of things, people are, like in the pig butchering kind of model, fattened, as it were, and encouraged to engage and to trust the people that they're interacting with through Messenger, through encrypted apps and so on, to be able to think, oh no, I can gamble away and I'm going to be really successful and I'm going to make a lot of money, and they lose everything. And it can, you know, in the cases of the things with pig butchering in Southeast Asia, I mean, people can lose their entire life savings. So it has a very devastating effect.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we're 12 months on now. What has happened to those workers who were arrested, and what about the one behind this operation? Have they faced justice?
Well, we don't know. This is part of the sort of one of the big unknowns. We don't know, what sort of criminal groups might be behind it, or what the involvement of, you know, other people might be, people who mentioned in the story, and it doesn't seem that there's an ongoing investigation into what they discovered, as far as we know. We couldn't find any evidence of that. So that's potentially frustrating, from the victim's point of view. And the people who were involved, as I understand it, there were at least 12 people detained, and it's unclear how many were deported.
Yeah, I mean, a country like Palau, it's obviously not the biggest country. Does it have, the resources to be able to carry out investigations of this nature and to root these operations out going forward?
Well, what I was told, and it's quoted in the piece, is that, in fact, yeah, they don't. They are, of course, making an effort to try and tackle it. But the cybercrime laws, I mean, this is part of the problem, is the legislation on the book is relatively minimal. So people who might want to exploit that loophole could have a bit of a bonanza. Although they do have lists of unwanted aliens, as they call them, which is people who've been discovered to be involved in something unsavory who aren't allowed back in the country.
Yeah.
But when there's lots of money to be made, I mean, I think it's quite plausible that, you know, they'll keep coming.
Yeah, well, it leads me into my next question. I mean, do you think this scam centre in Palau was an isolated case, or do you think there might be others out there in the Pacific?
Well, having spoken to people who know about this sort of thing, I mean, certainly we were hearing that that there's evidence of other cases or that people are investigating other cases. And I suppose where there are sort of lacunae in the law where people can sort of set themselves up, because there aren't laws to sort of prevent and deter this, it's more than possible that could be going on. And in the past, there were some pretty sizable raids in Palau alone on New Year's Eve in 2019, as we reported in the previous story. It's certainly something that I think remains an ongoing threat. And people are concerned, people in the government that I spoke to were concerned that it would continue in Palau as well.
Yes, well, from what I understand, these scam centres, they can't just be set up anywhere, can they? Like, they need good infrastructure, you know, good telecommunications, things like that, which I think Palau has got. But does that mean, I guess, you know, other countries who might be a bit poorer in those aspects might be spared from, you know, being targeted by these operations?
No, I don't think so necessarily, because people can get things like the Musk Starlink, and that's the classic thing that a lot of people use, and you can set yourself up with that pretty much anywhere. And recently there was a case which was reported by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime in Timor-Leste, which is, you know, getting pretty close to Australia, where they found what was a suspected scam center operation, which was using all of that, you know, in a free trade zone. So I think it will continue to proliferate, because actually if people have the money to be able to set up these sorts of operations, employ a lot of people, then they're going to clearly have the money to get Starlink and you know, set themselves up somewhere where they think they won't be discovered for long periods of time. So it seems to be, you know, an ongoing threat, I think.
Yeah, it's a bit of a question without notice coming up, but I mean, just listening to, you know, how these groups operate and the methods they use, particularly with the workforce aspect, with human trafficking and things like that, it makes me wonder what could happen, you know, once they get their hooks into things like AI and the potential damage an industry like this could cause. Is that something that you've seen reported on or investigated or anything like that?
Well, excuse me. So it's certainly a concern that people are talking about, and it's the combination of AI and crypto, right? Because, I mean, crypto, if you have a company that's, you know, offshore and things are going through multiple jurisdictions with crypto, I mean, then you can't really prosecute somebody who's overseas, right? You can only sort of track it as far as it goes. And it's highly anonymized through networks like Tron, which we saw in one of the cases in Palau. Which makes it really, really difficult. And, of course, AI just makes it even more, incredibly hard to be able to counter. And it seems that quite a lot of the people who want to set themselves up in the Pacific might be doing it to target people in other jurisdictions. So then you don't have victims in the country itself, which also makes it sort of diabolically hard to prosecute. That's I think you've highlighted a major issue there. I mean, AI just complicates everything.
It's certainly not a comforting thought, that's for sure. And I guess with that, we'll leave the interview there because we are running out of time. But Emmanuel, thanks so much for joining us today on Pacific Beat.
My pleasure, thank you.
That was Emmanuel Stokes, writer and reporter with the Organised Crime and Corruption Reporting Team, and he was talking with me there from New Zealand.
Celebrate this Christmas Eve with a Pacific Christmas. featuring the uplifting voices of the Pacifica Victoria Choir. Enjoy a magical evening of traditional and island-inspired Christmas songs ready to light up your Christmas season. A Pacific Christmas, 5 p.m. PNG time, Christmas Eve, and also on Christmas Day at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat, and we go to Tonga now, where there's public concern over new restrictions on travelling to the United States. The new rules come into effect next week, banning the citizens of a dozen countries from travelling to the US. For Tonga, it's not a total ban. Instead, the US will no longer issue new tourist and business visas. The US State Department says this is because of overstaying, lack of data sharing between the two governments, and the reliability of birth certificates. Viliame Tupaka'u Jr. is a teacher who has worked in Japan and other parts of the world. He says he's neither surprised by the new rules, nor is he expecting to have it to have too much impact on the lives of Tongans. But he says the source of the problem lies with Tonga's past policies on passports.
I think I would share a lot of the same reaction as people in my age group, 36, 35. And basically because since we've grown up knowing that the Tongan government had this really bad policy to sell passports in the early 90s, it's come as no surprise to us that the credibility of the Tongan passport goes down, especially for a country like the United States. And, you know, I think around that time when the passports were being sold, it was mostly to Chinese nationals or Hong Kong. So if you look at the current situation in the Pacific, it's been quite contested between the United States and China. And so I think a lot of people in my generation, it's no surprise that these ban restrictions have come on the Tongan passport for us.
How do you think these restrictions will affect Tongans, given that there's a significant amount of the population in the US and I'm sure there's lots of travel? What sort of impacts do you think this will have in next year when these restrictions come into place?
Ultimately, I don't think it'll affect Tongan travelers very much. I think Tongans will still be able to travel into Hawaii and into the United States to visit their families in Utah. So as far as I know in Tonga, most of the migration pattern here goes towards New Zealand and Australia. So only a small amount of Tongans would be affected, and those would be the ones choosing to go to the United States.
So you don't think there'll be too much of an impact on ordinary Tongans?
I don't think so. I think these restrictions, once they're filing it out, and whether it's the embassy here in Nuku'alofa or in Fiji, they will be able to pretty much scrutinize really well each individual and the reasons for travel.
So just looping back to those passports you were talking about, is it a worry then that the new Prime Minister has flagged the passports as one key way that Tonga could be looking at improving its economy and dealing with government revenue?
100% disagree with the Prime Minister or any government is going to think that's a good way to bring in money for Tonga. It's kind of like the third world thinking, right? You know, if you really want to be serious about it, listen to the voices of our people. They're so proud. Mate mā Tonga, they're so proud to be Tongan overseas. And what are they going to do? They're going to sell it. They're going to sell the national identity. And the people that's going to affect the most is the future generations. The younger people, they're basically robbing them of credibility. And it's really, really dangerous because a lot of our youth, you know, Tonga is so small, this island cannot fulfill the potentials of our young generations. They have to go overseas to study. They have to go to be better at rugby, to open their businesses, to develop the skills and trade, right? So selling these passports for a short-term gain is a huge mistake. And it's kind of an insult to the everyday Tongan person, really.
In the Pacific, we've seen situations where Vanuatu has sold its passports. Other countries are also looking in the same direction. And with Vanuatu, we've seen cases where criminals have been using Vanuatu passports to access the European Union. As a result, there's an EU ban on Vanuatu visas. Is there a worry from you, from yourself, that this will lead to problems?
I recently returned from France, and I had a whole set of people in front of me who were questioned many times. When I put my passport through at the gate in Paris, they let me in as if I was French myself. It was so easy. And that is incredibly valuable, and I treasure that. And I went to stay with my cousin and felt right at home and already learning how to speak French. And you know, that is something incredibly valuable that the Tonga people here don't understand. They have. If you are going to sell passports, you're going to kill the credibility of what it means to be Tongan when you go through these gates around the world.
That was former teacher Viliami Tupakau Jr. speaking there to the ABC's Evan Wazuga. Well, after more than 20 years in the PNG music industry, award-winning artiste Mau Meninga Kuri says he's fighting a battle to save the authentic sound and spirit of Papua New Guinea's legendary performers. The threat comes from AI, artificial intelligence, and the rising prevalence of computer-generated cover versions of songs that offer no financial benefit to their creators whatsoever. In a passionate social media post, Mau described the practice of AI covers as unethical and disrespectful. Now his campaign is gathering momentum, and as Richard Hewitt reports, there is growing support not just from within the music industry, but from the corridors of power as well.
One Vibe Production.
Cover version of a classic song, the late Daniel Billups' Promise, and it's generating a lot of love on YouTube. Its creators insist their intention is to celebrate the incredible artistry. But Daniel's brother-in-arms, Mau Meninga Kuri, doesn't see it that way. Instead, he sees a piece of work by AI and a song taken without permission.
People are trying to use it to gain more popularity and fame, but they don't see the main impact that it can give to us musicians and artists. If we, as an individual who has interest in music, use it as a tool to do our music with our own lyrics, own voice, and then you can tell AI to do your create your music, but they are not doing that way. They're using songs released by legend artists to create a cover version, which is not right. If they monetize their YouTube, then they're making money out of it, and we can say they're stealing someone's hard work.
So what can be done to stop this from happening? Mal's view is that streaming services like Spotify and YouTube should ensure that all AI-generated music is identified as such, and where songs have been taken without permission, they should be removed.
Yes, definitely. If cover version done by AI is uploaded on their platform, they must remove it, because that's a total 100% copyright. It's not for me to talk about this, but especially those international artists can speak up for everyone.
The powers that be have responded to Mal's concerns, and he was invited to talks with the Department of Information, Communication and Technology. And PNG's chief censor, Jim Abani, says problems with AI first came to his attention at a time when his office was promoting a campaign to ensure that music lived up to required standards of decency.
The first issue brought up on AI-generated music was in Lae, when we had a workshop on music regulation to ensure that it is appropriate for PNG listeners, and also it must be within our country's values and context that we want to promote.
Government, you have to do something to protect your people. We musicians and artists are part of this country, and we are the one who promotes our country to the outside world so that the tourists can come. It's something that will help us boost tourism.
Time even stop is lonely. He said we will go. Maybe cruise go down on the Gua market. Won't give me you right, cause
Well, the chief censor has promised action, but he says there is a need for government departments to join forces to assist artists to protect their copyright.
All of government approach is the only way that we can assist our local artists. Regulating AI music in Papua New Guinea, there are some potential strategies that I can recommend for agencies within the space to help our local artists. One of them is the copyright law. If it is outdated, we need to review that. Licensing and royalties is something that we have to establish this licensing to give that rightful owners so that they can benefit.
Although he's leading the charge against AI copies, Mal says he's not a victim, at least not yet, and he wants to educate people about how he believes AI should be used in the PNG music industry.
Most of us, we are using auto-tunes and we record music in studios with computers, but for you to put your vocal in, you have to be authentic. Your voice has to be there so that people will see, people will know, people will understand, and then people will invite you to come and perform live. You cannot tell AI to sing songs for you on stage.
But a quick glance at the comments under any of the AI-generated covers online right now tells you that listeners don't know the songs are not real or that the artists don't actually exist, and they love the song so much, they want more. And that's what concerns Malmaninga Kuri most, the thought that what he calls the flavour and spirit of music made in Papua New Guinea is being put at risk.
My concern is the taste that we had from the original artist will fade away. When it fades, the name of the legend will die off. The new generation that are coming up, they won't even know that it's from a senior artist. They will think that the original artist is the AI producer. The culture and the tradition and the taste of PNG music that is dying out because of AI.
First time to me been meeting you, now meeting him.
That was AI-created music from Papua New Guinea, which Malmaninga Kuri says risks tearing the heart out of the PNG music industry. And the reporter there was Richard Hewitt. It is Wednesday, December 24, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and if you're just tuning in, there has been no shortage of news this morning despite the Christmas countdown, with Vanuatu's National Teachers Union ending an 18-month-long strike after finally reaching an agreement with the government. Meanwhile, in Palau, documents have emerged linking international scammers to local businesses. And PNG music artiste Malmaninga Kuri has launched a campaign to save PNG's music industry from AI-generated covers.
People are trying to use it to gain more popularity and fame, but they don't see the main impact that it can give to us musicians and artists.
Yeah, it's a compelling listen, so please catch up on that at the Pacific Beat homepage a bit later after the show. But in the meantime, there is plenty more to come. Switching gears to sport now, and Darren Lockyer's bold purchase of UK rugby league club, the London Broncos, has dominated headlines in recent weeks. His plan to haul the second-tier club back to the top-flight English Super League has been dubbed by some as rugby league's answer to Welcome to Wrexham, the hit doco series which follows a Welsh football club's journey up the ranks of English soccer. It remains to be seen whether Lockyer's project will draw a similar appeal, but one place that has well and truly jumped on board is Papua New Guinea. Lockyer has recruited several PNG national players to help fulfil his Super League ambitions, and PNG fans have flocked to the club's fan page to show their support. To find out more, I'm joined by one of the London Broncos fan page administrators, Adam Perry, who joins us on the line from the UK. Adam, good evening to you.
Good evening, Carl. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Now, I'm actually a member of your fan page myself, having clicked the follow button somewhat recently, and I know I'm not the only one who's done that since Lockyer's purchase. Give us a general idea, if you can, of just how many new members have come aboard and how many of them are from PNG.
It's been great. I mean, this fan page has been going pretty much since the start of Facebook, so we notice when we get a lot of new members, and we certainly have had probably about, I'd say, 400 or 500 over the last couple of months since you know, since the whole change, the whole move, and obviously the inclusion of lots of PNG players into the team for next year.
Yeah, no, it is fantastic. I think I was looking last night, and there was currently listed at about 2,200 members on the fan page at the moment. Has the activity really ramped up, I suppose, compared to what it was like prior to Lockyer's purchase?
It has. I mean, because I've got a bit of prior knowledge about the sort of PNG market, I knew that it would do because, you know, PNG is kind of legendary when it comes to rugby league and England. Obviously, everyone down under knows about PNG and all the players. But, you know, having a country whose national sport is actual rugby league is really exciting. And, you know, it's not like PNG kind of permutates much of our lives over down here in the UK. But for rugby league, it certainly does. And to have a lot of new fans, it's really exciting. It really is. I know, Carl, that a lot of our fans have said, why don't we get the huge PNG community in the UK involved? I had to kind of explain that there really isn't one. There's not much of a PNG diaspora. So, you know, there were all lots of fans going, let's get the whole community down and watch a game. I said, well, you might struggle a little bit with that. But let's get people in PNG involved themselves.
Yeah, look, I'm looking forward to learning a bit more about your Melanesian connections a little bit later in the chat. But I suppose just first, give us an idea of what the general feeling of the club is like at the moment. Is there a fair bit of optimism compared to what there might have been over the last decade or so?
I mean, you can't compare it. I've been a Broncos fan for about 30 years, and we've played at about 20 different places, 25 different places. We've had lots of different owners. And whilst, you know, our recent owners have done their very best, they've done a great job. The last time probably we felt as excited was at the end of the last century. We had Richard Branson, who owned the club. We made a big final at Wembley Stadium, which was a huge, probably still the biggest day for the club since then. But with Darren Lockyer's involvement, you know, one of the biggest legends in rugby league, a proper rugby league name, proper rugby league man. I don't think I've ever heard so many rugby league fans south of Wigan so excited. It's been, you know, everybody cannot wait now. We really are just busting to get down there at the start of next year.
Yes, you did mention Mr. Branson and obviously Darren Lockyer. He's not the first person to not the first high profile person I should say who's purchased this team. He's obviously doing things I guess a little bit more creatively than people in the past. But do you think as someone who's watched the team for a long time, is there anything that he can do I guess to maybe avoid some of the past mistakes of the previous owners have made?
Yeah, well, it's tough. London is a tough market. You know, soccer is obviously king, and then we've got so many soccer teams, big Premier League teams, rugby union, cricket, you know, even ice hockey people are going to watch. So it's a tough ask, but with, you know, we need that marketing skill, that marketing knowledge, which I think Lockyer and his colleagues from down under will bring. That's really important. It needs to be a project. It needs to be more long-term. And from what I've heard and from what everyone's heard, that's what we think it's going to be. Again, I think putting roots down, London and Broncos have moved around quite a lot over the last 40, 50 years. We've got a great little home in South London. I'm actually from North London, so the other side. But, you know, ultimately, we just want somewhere to call home. We've got a huge catchment area. There isn't another, I think some other teams might grumble at me saying this, but there's not another huge rugby league team for another 300 kilometres probably.
Yes.
North of London. So we, you know, it's about getting the community not only in South London, in Wimbledon, which I guess a lot of your listeners will know because of the tennis, but it's about bringing people from all around the south of England, the southeast, bringing them together. And that's a big job. You know, we're talking tens of millions of people, and it's a tough marketing job, but it sounds like he's saying all the right things and he's getting the experts in. You know, we've been there and done it all before, but this is sounding pretty much as good as I've heard for a very long time.
No, that's great to hear. And look, you mentioned some of those challenges with soccer, and I imagine living in the north of London and driving all that way to the south, you'd go past a lot of soccer or football clubs on the way.
There's a lot, yeah.
Now, you mentioned a little bit earlier that you do have an interesting Melanesian connection. Can you tell us about some of the outreach work you've done, and particularly with the West Papuan Rugby League team?
Sure, of course. So I actually lived in Sydney 2006, 2007, and I'd not heard about the cause of West Papua up until then. I obviously heard of PNG, but I found out a lot about it when I lived in Sydney. When I came back to the UK, I reached out to the West Papuan community. We have a chap called Benny Wender, who is the leader of the Free West Papua campaign globally. Him and his wonderful family live in Oxford. I became friends with them. And I did a lot of fundraising, we put on some concerts, but obviously my passion is sport, in particular rugby league. So I reached out to some of the guys in PNG who actually started a team. I think we're probably talking 8-9 years ago, originally called the West Papua Warriors. They're now the One Papua Warriors. And they came over to the UK 4 or 5 years ago in a nines competition. They absolutely destroyed it. They beat everybody. but since then, I've been advocating for the Warriors and for West Papua All Sports. So rugby league, rugby union, you know, when we have Pacific teams down here, we have the World Cup here and everything. Always going along with my West Papua flag. But still involved in the campaign deeply. It's something I'm really, really passionate about. And, you know, and a lot of people in PNG, obviously, very passionate about. And we're hoping that we can use all these guys coming over to, you know, to help, I guess, raise awareness of not only the West Papua Warriors, but the cause of West Papua full stop.
Yeah, it's incredible that your worlds have been able to collide in this way. And I understand you even had a chat with Jason Demetrio recently and told him a bit about it. Is that right?
I did. I told him a bit about it because, you know, Jason, he obviously, you know, he's comes in and out of PNG and he's probably not aware of the whole bigger picture and the community. So I told him about it. He was really interested. It was great to meet him. So accessible, you know. He came down just before Christmas. We had a fans group get together and he came down and talked to fans, and I had my One Papua Warriors shirt on, as I often do. And I was just telling him about it. And I'm, you know, I know a lot of the guys who play for the Warriors also know some of the guys who are coming over to play for the Broncos next year. So hopefully we can have a good chat with them and, you know, and see what we can do with that.
Yeah, it's great to hear that the Broncos are already doing some outreach work with the fans. Now, let's talk some on-field stuff quickly because we are running out of time, but obviously the season begins in January. It's really exciting. But I'll tell you, I've got to say, I've read some things online which basically, you know, I even saw a headline earlier on today which said this might be the greatest championship team ever assembled. Do you agree with that, or does it make you nervous? Or like, give us an idea of how hard the championship division is to win and get out of.
So the championship is hard, and we've now got, they've kind of brought in the second and the third tier all as one. So we've got some new teams as well, and it is tough. It's really, really tough. You've got some big, really famous old teams in there. And I think people probably are maybe getting overexcited. I don't want to get too overexcited and don't want to get too cocky right now, because we have got some great players. We've got some incredible talent. Obviously, a lot of guys who have come over from the Hunters. We've got about 7 PNG players who have come. We've got Campbell Gillard, a prop who's, you know, over 250 games in the NRL. Some great young British talent that we've had for a few years. Look, it's we've got to keep our feet firmly on the ground, but we are really excited. And hopefully, you know what, wins brings more fans in, and that's what we're hoping for. But you can probably hear I'm pretty excited and quite hopeful for, you know, for success this year.
Oh, look, I think we all are. I haven't been to London for about 12 or 15 years, but I've got a reason to go back now. That's for sure.
You certainly do.
Adam, that's all we've got time for, but thanks so much for jumping on the phone at 8:30 PM where it is in your time at the moment. It was great chatting and I look forward to, can't wait to see how the season unfolds.
Great to speak to you. Thanks so much.
That was Adam Perry, a lifelong London Broncos fan and administrator of the London Broncos Facebook fan page.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, it's just one more sleep until we wake up on Christmas Day, and across the Pacific, the sounds of Christmas carols have been ringing in towns and villages. For residents of Port Moresby, they've been getting a special treat, their carols sung to them in Kuanau, the language of East New Britain. Hilda Wayne with this Christmas Eve story.
The days leading up to Christmas has been busy for the Port Moresby Matopuit Choir Sing Sing group. James Lumaris says his choir members come from one place, East New Britain, and the youngest singer is just 7 years old. The group is a hit in Port Moresby. Their Facebook posts draws thousands of followers.
Only because we do traditional dancing, choir and string band, so for entertainment. So we've been doing a lot of choir recently, and I know that's trending on every social media platforms. Yeah, we decided to do them scheduled for like 2 weeks, and apparently because of popular demand and the guys, we started singing again last night. So we're gonna do it until the 24th. So it's basically it. So I think it's been a hit since 2020 when we started. So we wanted to do, so we scheduled for 40 hours and apparently we're going past 50 now. So that's what we're dealing with now. And I guess a lot of people, they like the carols being sung in our native Kwanawa language in Tolai, Eastern Britain. So yeah, so it's just a choir, only men. Only males only. We're inclusive of both young men, boys, and older of our relatives. Yeah, with the group that we have majority that were unemployed. Majority are unemployed, so just stay home folks. And some of our members are students. Some are working. So we have that mixture of unemployed, employed, and students. So, yeah, we have our youngest member who's 7, yeah.
Christmas Eve is their final performance, and it's going to be a grand finale for the Port Moresby Matopuit Choir Sing Sing. Tonight will mark a total of 50 homes they've visited in the past 2 weeks.
We sing about like 4 to 5 songs, sorry. And then we move to the next house, and every house and family mindful that we have to sing like a couple of songs back and then move to the next house. Some that want to have us for a long time, they request that we stay for a long time, and then obviously we have to make our timing for the next houses again.
The group is made up of students, working dads, and unemployed youth in Port Moresby. They gather not only to sing, but also address social issues in the capital.
We've kind of, every now and then when we have a meeting or practice, we start by having a meeting and just going through like social issues and try to talk up young boys to be men, and you know just we have decision making in the current times. There's a lot of things going on, and people have to be, young men have to be mindful of the kind of decisions they make. You know, this world is not favorable. So yeah, so there's a lot of men amongst a lot who have they deal with certain issues personally, but we, as much as we can, we try to bring everybody together. So just so it takes off the members or their mind off, what they're going through. Yeah, because some people that come out there as aggressive and stubborn and all this, so we have to address it in the choir. Yeah.
Thank you. The money raised from the choir will go to schools in East New Britain and assist those whose lives were affected by the 1994 Matupit volcano eruption.
We put our charge on every house for $100, basically because we've been helping we had this fundraising drive to help our three main churches at home on the island of Matupit in Rabaul, Britain. So the Catholic United Church and SDA. This was one of the projects. We bought tanks and genset and stuff for the churches. Now we're looking into funding necessities for our schools back at on the island of Matupit and at the resettlement up in Sikut, Warangoi. So this is one of our main fundraising drive is to raise enough funds so we can buying desks and textbooks for our schools back at home.
That was the Port Moresby Matupit Choir singing in the Kuanua language and James Lamaris speaking there with the ABC's Hilda Wayne.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges, from how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today. Recapping our top story, PNG music artist Mal Meninga-Koori has launched a campaign to save PNG's music industry from AI-generated covers.
People are trying to use it to gain more popularity and fame, but they don't see the main impact that it can give to us musicians and artists.
Well, that'll be it for me for this year. I'll be back in January, around mid-January. I've got a little bit of a break coming up, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next, and coming up after that is Nija Daily. You'll find all our top stories on our website, type Pacific Beat, just into your search engine. With that, I say Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Have a great day.